Support for 30 Days of West Virginia Music is provided by Kinship Goods, proud supporter of DIY music and the arts, locally shipped worldwide at kinshipgoods.com.
That's the biggest thing, is being an adult about it, is taking music as a business as opposed to a hobby. And I mean that in the sense of not just, even people that do it seriously, it's still a hobby because you think they're going to love it. You know, it doesn't work that way.
I'm Joni Deutsch, and this is 30 Days of West Virginia Music, a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting and A Change of Tune. Throughout the month of June, we are celebrating some of the folks who are making the West Virginia music scene wild and wonderful. 30 days, 30 brand new West Virginia music interviews. And today, a gravelly, bluesy voice who has dipped his musical foot in the waters of Nashville and Nitro. This is Tony Hara. Can you introduce yourself and what do you do?
I am, my name is Tony Hara, and I am a singer-songwriter out of Nitro, West Virginia.
And how did you get started in music?
I wanted to be a musician since I was really little, when Kroger's used to sell VHS and albums and stuff. When you'd walk right through the front door in Taze Valley, I went in there and Prince's Purple Rain stared me right in the face in the mid-80s. And I realized that, like, that's what I wanted to do. So at one point in grade school, I crafted this whole outfit of, like, this rock star outfit, complete with guitar, like, out of paper with, like, rubber band strings. And I stuffed it in my backpack. And, like, when all the kids were, like, getting in their desks, I, like, went back and, like, dressed up and came back out. And they all laughed at me. But I thought it was awesome. I thought they were laughing with me. Looking back, I think there's a different perspective on that. It kind of laid dormant. I took piano lessons when I was a kid. I think a lot of people did. That was a thing to do in the 80s if you had a child. And by the time I was a teenager, I got like a guitar. A buddy of mine sold me a secondhand acoustic. And so I just, angry youth banging out like a bunch of Nirvana covers and, you know, the normal stuff. And I wanted to start my first blues band when I was 19. And I didn't see at the time how short-sighted that was, that you have no clout as a bluesman. You don't have much to be blue about at 19. And
acne, I guess.
Acne, you know, your girlfriend, you know, I guess the timeless love loss that is in all music, but not really anything people can really sink their teeth into. And I had Chris Itzen from Beggar's Clan and Tom McGee's. He was my saxophone player back then. We've known each other our whole lives. And that didn't really go anywhere. And then I joined a band called Side A Only, who was around from the early 2000s. Hmm. We played Regatta. That's how long ago it was.
Oh, my gosh. Regatta in Charleston, West Virginia.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, we played Regatta, and that was really nice. We thought we were big time there. We had, like, our own trailer before the show and whatnot. And I played drums for that band, and I was in there for a couple of years, and then joined another band in Huntington, and then we traveled. And then I got out of it in 2008. I moved back from Nashville. My father said, you know, it's been a good run. Maybe you should get a real job, you know, kind of thing. Ooh. So I got work as a part-time plumber with a guy who was my now wife's cousin. And I ended up starting my own construction company. And I did that until about 2-3 years ago. I'd been out of music for 5 or 6 years. And it kind of gnaws at you, you know. And so I decided a couple years ago I was going to get back and just playing jazz on the piano with a 3-piece. Just doing some covers. My wife kind of rolled around. She's like, never going to happen. And so then about a year and a half ago, I started writing music again. And I paid off my house. And so my wife's like, you have full reign. You can go out.
Good tour, for you.
Do what you want. Yeah, so I'm coming back and I'm going to hit it really hard this time. So
it sounds like you had a number of bands under your belt in your early musical career. What genres were they all focused on? I mean, it sounds like they were like alt rock to Americana kind of music.
Yeah, the blues band obviously was blues, and then Side A Only was, it was just rock. I guess, you know, our influence was like Pearl Jam and Tool and all sorts of stuff. So, but it was, you know, everything from heavy to medium rock, all original, of course. And then I joined the Dirty Mountain Pirates in Huntington with Sean Gordon and some guys up there, and that's the ones that we moved to Nashville. And I wrote for that band. Me and Sean wrote everything. And that band was, I always called it Appalachian Stomp Rock. I created my own genre for that. That's what I pushed it as in Nashville. I thought it was pretty funny. But it was like kind of Black Crowes-ish, you know, like just just American rock, you know. And but there was some, like, we were huge Wilco influences from, like, early Wilco albums. So I think there was a lot of element of, like, alt country in there too. So then I did the jazz thing. And I've done a bunch of acoustic duo type stuff. We did, like, cover stuff going out, like Ryan Adams covers. Like, those are some of my bigger influences. And so then I did the jazz group called Park Wherever a couple of years ago with Chris Itzen from Beggar's Clan and Joel Duffield from Saudi Only and my drummer now, Alex Long. And that was pretty fun. We did Rails Nails with that. But we just did a lot of, like, Tom Waits covers, like Warm Beer, Cold Women. And, you know, then I started writing for that group, and that's what kind of blossomed into. Some of the guys weren't really interested in going, like, full blues or Americana writing, and so I just kind of stopped and wrote a record and was like, I'll shop a band with the record. Like, if you'd like to do this, we'll do this together, you know, kind of thing. So I've kind of been all over, but I kind of stay in a small circle of music, you know.
You said that, you know, at the time that you really started getting into blues, you didn't really understand it. What influenced you to get more into the blues? Were there any artists in West Virginia at the time or ones that you're just listening to on vinyl or cassettes that were great?
Yeah, as far as blues go, I guess my biggest influence was probably Muddy Waters. I found him when I was like 16, so that's a pretty easy one, and I was pretty much taken back by that. And then I got really into James Cotton, the harmonica player, and I found out that James Cotton was the harmonica player on Muddy's last album, Hard Again in the 70s. And so I really got into James Cotton and some of the harmonica players, like Little Walter and Sonny Boy Williamson. So I kind of stayed with that, you know, Howlin' Wolf, you know, some of those. And it wasn't really until I got a lot older and mature, I really started seeking out, you know, Lightning Hopkins and some of the blues folks that, like, aren't as popular in that whole name the first five you can think of. And I found Tom Waits when I was in my early 20s. And at the time, maybe I just wasn't interested. I hate to even say that. But
he's kind of hard to get into, though. It's understandable.
He is. And then I was never a singer. I've never sang in any group in my life. In fact, it was a joke that I was a singer. When I started doing this, everybody was like, you're singing? And I was like, you know, I learned back in my late 20s that, you know, it was kind of a joke. I've heard people say, if Bobby D can do it, you know, sing. But I was like, man, you know, I've got a gravelly voice, and I think I got soul, I guess. You know,
I think I got soul
or something. I don't know. You know, I feel like I'm passionate about what I do. Maybe that's a better argument to it. But I figured if Tom Waits has that same range, you know, like, I could get by with it. And so I kind of started there, just basically saying, I'm not gonna worry about it. And so it's kind of blossomed into this. So that was a big influence of mine when I got into my late 20s all the way to now. So, and I like his writing. He has no fear to do anything.
No, of course not.
No, right. No.
What is it about blues, though, that really made you want to get into that genre in particular?
It's kind of like country in the effect that I really like that it's simple and it tells a really good story.
It is guttural. I mean, you can almost feel it in your chest.
Yeah.
When you're listening or if you're playing it.
And that's where I really wanted to get back into blues. And I was planning just staying there, you know. And I don't know if I'm ever able to really just stay in one genre. But I wanted to get in the blues. And the problem with that, though, is that I'm not a really good guitar player. Like, I mean, I can play the guitar well, but, like, I'm not, like, a lead guitar player. You know, like, the Bud Carrolls and guys out there, those are the guys that do it. And so when you play blues, you're either the guitar virtuoso that also sings it, or you've got a backing band. And so that leaves you playing rhythm guitar and writing the songs. And so I do a lot of stuff on slide guitar and resonator so I can go solo. But I found that when I tinged over into Americana, my guitar playing wasn't really so much an issue. It was like the songwriting and the story was what I found most important. So that's where I've kind of brought more of that out. You know? So, but I think it's all really a version of the blues, whether it's country or Americana or bluegrass. I think, like, the writing in it is a form of, you know, kind of stems from that blues idea, you know, a lot of it to me at least, or the emotion of it, maybe not the actual genre of the music. You know.
Yeah, I'm seeing now that there's not as many young people or, you know, people getting into playing the blues as much as there are now, like indie rock or alternative pop. So I wouldn't say blues is a dying genre, but it does seem like it's not getting as many, it's not getting as much new blood coming into it as others.
You know, I was reading a book that a friend of mine recommended called Why It Hurts So Good in the History of the Blues. And the blues was very popular in the South at one point. It was predominantly black music. It's flip-flopped completely now. And they were showing the statistics of where it's come in so many years is that, like, now it's like 90% white and like 89% like over the age of 50. Mm-hmm. And so there is some concern that there's a dying out of it, you know, without. But when I was down at the Memphis International Showcase that we played in February, you wouldn't believe how many young kids from all over the country were there.
That's great.
And they were really, really, and they're actually, they had a youth showcase for people under 18. Some of it was like, oh, that's cool. And some of it was like, wow, they're really good. And so, I mean, there was some of it just blew us away, you know. Some of the jams afterwards, some of the kids would get up there with actually a sheet of paper, and he had just written a blues song. And he starts going on about how his baby left him. And there were some chuckles from the older adults in the audience, kind of in that same, you know, what clout do you have in the blues? But it was really endearing, and they did it well, and their lead guitar player just, you know, tore it up, and it was really fun. So, I mean, I think there's another generation of there coming up if the flames are stoked well, you know, kept alive.
On in the evening when I'm trying to understand, trying to pick up what you're putting down.
You mentioned a little earlier that you moved down to Nashville from West Virginia to focus on your music. Can you talk about that transition?
We were playing a lot in Huntington, and it was back when the Monkey Bar was on 4th Avenue. It's still there.
Uh-huh, I remember that. Well, I mean, I shouldn't. What was that, in the early 90s? Was that?
No.
That
this was in mid-2000s.
Oh, yeah. I still remember. Yeah. No, I was born. Yeah.
Man, you aged me like another 10 years. That wasn't even fair.
No. I'm sorry. But I do remember the Monkey Bar. But yeah, I'm sorry. Continue.
And we played there a lot. We got to open up for some national acts there, and we were in pretty good there. And we did well in Huntington. And then about the time, see, American Miner had moved down to Champaign a couple years before, because my band, Saturday Only and Us, we knew those guys from high school. Other than Bud, he went to Huntington, but the guys from Winfield, I still know them. So we'd played a little bit with them, and then they'd moved to Champaign. Mm-hmm. And so that had already got to cut my idea that, you know, if you're going to do something, you might need to leave here. It's great to be from here, but, you know. So it was, you know, sometime in 2004, I think, something like that, suggested that, you know, maybe we should go somewhere else. And I thought, you know, me and my wife talked about, why don't you move to Nashville, you know? And so I got with the guys in the band. They were like, sure. And so we all packed up and we moved down there. And we were trying to work with a small independent label down there out of Franklin. And we got a house and we all lived in the house together. I don't know now if it was the coolest thing we ever did or the dumbest thing we ever did. But, you know, like me and the drummer shared a bedroom, and the guitarist and the bassist shared a bedroom. And then we kept one bedroom for practice and stuff. So it was hilarious, like, who took their roles as, like, you know, who always was in charge of doing the certain things, you know. But it's funny how we domesticated ourselves together like that. But we played some down there. We played the Gibson Showcase down there. That was before the flood, and it's not there anymore. And we did some stuff down on Broadway, like the Red Iguana was down there, and there were some clubs down there that were pretty good. We did a lot better on the Vanderbilt side and then, like, Murfreesboro and Franklin. But, you know, you kind of think it's the land of milk and honey. It is and it isn't. There's a lot more opportunities there, but there's a lot more people looking for those same opportunities. So, like, I don't know if the ratio is any different of playing here with less opportunities as far as clubs and people to see you, but there's also less artists. So, like, I think it almost just kind of translates. And a couple years in, my wife now didn't move there with me. So that was strenuous in our relationship. We ended up breaking up, and I came home to visit one time, and we kind of got back together. And then at this point, I was like, you know, maybe it's time to move home. So I left, and I was the one that kind of commandeered everybody to go down there. Well, they're all still there. They're like 12 years later, they're all still in Nashville. So whenever I go down there now, I visit. But that's when I moved home, and it was a really good experience. I met a lot of people that I'm still friends with, and it taught me a lot about the music industry, and it taught me that I didn't know anything about it when I moved down there. So
what were some of the things that you learned from the music industry down there?
Well, it's not always bad to be a bigger fish in a small pond. I thought it'd be great to be a small fish in a big pond, you know. A lot more room to swim. I could keep going with that, you know, for a while, but all sorts of analogies I could throw into that metaphor. But, you know, I realized that you really need a reason to move there. And at the time, social media wasn't there yet. Being able to record on your own was just starting to be affordable, you know, and so you still needed Nashville. By the time I moved home, I was right on that cusp where technology really started to break through, and all of a sudden, you didn't need to live in Nashville anymore. And so by the time I left there, I was like, I don't need to be here. And so that lesson I learned at a really odd point in technology, as the way it was moving, was I was right there where you did and then now you don't. And the other thing was, you know, networking. As a young artist, you kind of think that your music will stand for itself. And right, thanks for laughing with it.
Hey, no, I'm not saying that's. There's so many different little. It's a possibility. It's a possibility. It's just. It's a possibility that doesn't always happen.
No, and it really, you know, in fact, I had a publicist that I was consulting with in Nashville recently that told me, you know, having a great record will fail 99.9% of the times without the right publicity, without it being marketed right, without the right timeline. And so you think, like, people are going to hear this and be blown away by it, and somebody's going to take notice of it. And the thing is that will never happen. And there's so many good artists that will go unknown for their entire lives.
Yeah.
But the quote, and I don't know who said it, but it's fairly well known that music is a business of relationships. It's not unlike anything else, like politics or construction or anything where, like, networking, getting to know the right people is where you get your ins and your outs and your breaks. That's where I focus now. Like, when it's time, I spend a lot of time writing a record. I spend a lot of time, you know, working on the music. But then when I'm done, like, I spend most of my time just meeting people and trying to make contacts and then just have relationships. And it's funny where those doors will, hey, you should come down and check this out, or, you know, bring this down, or I listen to this, you know, so.
There's so many different components to just making and releasing a record. I mean, you're right. It's not just having a really good sound or having something you're so very proud of. That's great. Mm-hmm. And that's personally satisfying. But I mean, it's all like knowing the exact date that you should be releasing something and how that's not going to conflict with another big artist or another regional artist mm-hmm. doing something that day too, because maybe that's going to divide your audience. It's like there's so many little things that people don't really consider when getting into this kind of line of work.
Yeah, I mean, that's very well put. I mean, you don't think about all the business side of it. You're still somewhat a child in music, no matter how old you get, that you're really excited about an album. You've got this friends and family and local fans push, so you think, you know, it's just got all this force behind it. And really, there's not any force behind it. And, you know, I've been talking to a publicist out of Portland, and we're going to have a conference call tomorrow about working on my next record. And, you know, I was going to start recording in the midsummer, and I was going to try to release it late fall, and they were like, no. We'll tell you when to release it, first off, so you just don't even worry about that. You let us know when you have the masters done, and then we'll go from there. And I was like, okay. And so they were like, if you have the masters done by the end of summer, we're probably talking mid-spring. I was like, oh, okay. Well, yeah, I thought we needed like 3 months. She's like, no. Again, we'll handle that. You just make the record. And so to get a good push behind it nationally, you know, and make a run at something, there's people that know what they're doing. I mean, this is why it's called the music industry. I mean, they know what they're doing. And so I don't, you know, I think this is awesome. People are going to love it. They're like, no, they won't. Just trust us, you know. And so that's the biggest thing is being an adult about it, is taking music as a business as opposed to a hobby. And I mean that in the sense of not just, even people that do it seriously, it's still a hobby because you think they're going to love it, you know. It doesn't work that way.
It's a little crushing in a way, because you're thinking it's something I love to do, I can do it, people should love it, and then realizing I'm one of very many that are doing this, and maybe people won't hear about it. And on my side as a radio person, you know, I try to make an effort of listening to all kinds, because I know there's always the top 40 that will always get the promotional push, the love, mm-hmm. and the ones at the very bottom, especially the regional artists, it takes a lot of money to be able to create this promotional backing behind you, mm-hmm. and some people don't have that, even if they do have the great product.
Right, and money can be an issue, but I think honestly, if you have a big base of fans and stuff, you can crowdfund and stuff nowadays. That's getting tougher because so many people are doing it.
Yeah,
but that's always a possibility. And for me, basically, I'm just one of those, like, however it will happen, you know. And somehow things always tend to work out. So I'll you know, put the money where it needs to come from. And you know, I think people also think that stuff's a lot more expensive than it is. And it's really not, you know. I mean, it is. Depends on what your perspective is.
Yeah.
If you're like 18, it's a ton of money. But if you're in your 30s, like, that's really not that much money. And you can you know, find all sorts of ways to come up with it.
Yeah, it's an investment.
An investment. Yeah. But it's the most crushing thing is when you find out that your music is really just a product. It's no different than, you know, a package of soap or anything else on the shelf, and they've got to market it. So as far as the music industry looks at it, like, to them, it's just a product. How do we sell the product? And so that's the crushing thing that you have to, like, get past yourself long enough to be like, okay, yeah, I know. Let's just
get another bar of soap on the shelves.
Get another bar of soap on the shelves and make this one be the prettiest. Hopefully we can sell it. But there's an element that you look at the world and you go like, yeah, if they can't make money, they wouldn't be in this. Yeah. And so, you know, it is what it is. So my next album's going to be all top 40 pop. So is what we're working towards, so that we can.
Sure. Instead of Ryan Adams covers, it's going to be Taylor Swift covers, doing Ryan Adams, doing Taylor Swift.
Exactly. I was going to say, like, for a guy, like, I mean, that's the coolest thing I've seen an artist do in so long. He's like, I'll take Taylor Swift's album, I'll re-record it, and I'll make it really cool.
Sounded good. You did a good job with it.
Great.
And like, in some cases, I played it, and if I had not told anyone that it was Taylor Swift covers, they wouldn't have even known.
Like, Shake It Off. I thought was going to be like the hardest one to do. And as soon as I heard it, I was like, I remember my wife walked out. She's like, what do you listen to? And I was like, that's Ryan Adams on Taylor Swift. She was like, I thought I recognized the song. And but it's really good. So, you know, but that's what I'm doing. Yeah. Tony Hara covering Ryan Adams covering Taylor Swift.
I wish you all the best.
Thank you. Thank you. It's going to be something.
We talked about your blues and Nashville. Let's talk about where you are right now. So you're back in West Virginia, mm-hmm. You're in Nitro, and you're currently working with Tony Hara and the Putnam Prohibition. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah. I decided that my next band would be my name and the band.
Yeah.
And I did that, you know, I always thought it was smart. Ryan Adams did that. He was Whiskey Town, and then he was Ryan Adams and the Cardinals. He doesn't have to worry about this name branding thing as much as I do, but when the Cardinals dropped off and whatever, he did solo stuff, there was some name recognition there.
Yeah.
So if we were just a band called, you know, the Whatevers, if I got into solo, there's this whole, well, who is he and who's he with? And so you have to explain it all the time. So I was like, I'm going to do a Tony Hara and. And so I've got Alex Long out of Taze Valley and Mark Coppola, a longtime blues player out of Taze Valley, and Jeff Baugus, the same, Taze Valley, and longtime blues player. And Anders Busch, bass player extraordinaire, he's in Hurricane as well. He's played all over with tons of in studio and with tons of folks, and then Matt Hale, who is a producer and studio musician for Harvest Studios in Huntington. His family owns it.
Hmm.
He does a lot of work in Nashville, and he's probably one of the best keyboard and organ piano players I've ever played with in my life. So he grew up doing it as a studio musician. It was like, learn this now, or we'll get somebody else kind of thing. And he's really good. And so we put together and then recorded our first record, $2 Suit. And so I play with them. They don't have the ability to tour, and they don't have the ability to play as often as I do. So then I do a lot of solo shows, which I thought was going to be really scary, like just to get out there. And the thing was, I wrote a lot of music for the band. I based it around having a band. So my demos were leaving me with this sparse rhythm guitar and to not cloud everything up. It was really hard to translate that solo. So I had to revamp my plan of starting to write music from the ground up and then, you know, add them to it. But it's really cool to see how I change the songs in my mind, you know, when I play solo versus the band. So it's actually been really fun to have like almost a whole different style of set.
And have you recorded that version?
Well, no.
Because I've heard of bands that have done the kind of more acoustic fare of the same record, which is the more, I mean, even Connor Oberst just did that recently. He did the full-fledged one that had like Jim James of My Morning Jacket and a few others on it. Before that, he did the one that was just himself.
Yeah, so our first record, $2 Suit, was a big, just electric blues blowout. For my second record, I put it out really soon after that one, 3 months later, and the reason was I was doing so many solo shows and I was traveling solo that it's hard to give somebody a CD or send a press kit, and they're like, what does you sound like? It's like this, but without all that other stuff. That wasn't working well, so I thought, I've got to put something together that represents me solo.
Yeah.
And so I still added a lot of guys on it, and there's a lot of players on it, but it's definitely stripped way down.
And the one that you're talking about right now is your newest release, which is Oklahoma Blues.
Yes.
Okay.
And so I put together a lot of stuff, and then, you know, we've got some percussion. I play several instruments on it. The biggest player on the whole thing was Mark, my harmonica player. Some of the songs are just me and him. And I play, like, organ on it and slide guitar and lap steel and regular guitar and a bunch of stuff. But my drummer did some percussion. A lead guitar player, Jeff, did some backup vocals, and then we had a cello player, who's our harmonica player's daughter. She goes to UK, came in and did some cello on us.
Oh.
So I wanted something really stripped down. So our plan was to go back this year and do 5 or 6 of those songs full band. So we were going to do it kind of in reverse and really just kind of blow them out. I don't know if we're going to be able to do that as we thought, because I'm making a big push to do this record, which is going to take a while, but if we can get the time, we're definitely going to do it. Because when we do them live with the band, they're a totally different sound, which almost is kind of fun. People expect one thing, and they're like, whoa, we're getting like everybody in on it, which is really cool. So,
you mentioned it was a little difficult with being in a band just because the coordination of schedules and, you know, mm-hmm. time conflicts, all that. I mean, ideally, would you, moving forward, want to continue being in a band, or do you think the solo route is more your scene?
No, I think this is a perfect opportunity to let all the guys in my band know that we're breaking up. and that you guys are out, and I'm in, and it's been really fun.
No, but, like, there's so many things. Like, being a band is great. You have the commitment, the responsibilities divided up. Obviously, the camaraderie in the studio. But being solo, though, I mean, it does give you the flexibility to go and do things and schedule for yourself. I mean, I could see pros, cons for both.
Yeah, I love being in my band, and there's a sound that will never be grabbed by any other way than just with those guys. I guess if they could, like, tour, you know, there would be no issue. I'd just always play with the band. As long as I play locally, I'll always play with my band. Unless, like, sometimes, you know, I do Empty Glass shows on, like, Wednesday nights, and I go on at 11. And so my lead guitar player is a doctor of psychology, and he's like, man, I'm out. And, you know, a lot of them have got early jobs, and so I don't hold that against them at all. But it's like, hey, we're going to do a Friday night here, and they're like, we're in, so, you know, we'll do it. So I basically just, as long as they're willing to play and as long as we can schedule it, they're going to be my band for as long as they want to ride it out. So
that gets to the heart of the matter, though, that venues in West Virginia and how there is a number of them that are pretty good venues that just really apparently like late shows on weekdays, and it's hard for people to come out, let alone for the bands to be able to manage day jobs when they're playing at like midnight mm-hmm. up until like 2 or 3 in the morning on like a Thursday or Wednesday.
Yeah, I mean, and I put on that interview form that I think earlier shows would be a good thing. And I've talked to, you know, Jason Robinson in length about it, man. We've sat there and texted each other for like
from the
hours.
Empty Glass.
From the Empty
yeah,
Glass
yeah.
In the tavern. Roadblock, I'm sure, would probably be better. Everybody would know him better by that. But, and he's tried to work in some earlier shows. They went from 10 to 1 to 9:30 to 12:30 at the Boulevard Tavern. And that's not a lot, but it's something. But he said everybody says they want early shows. They all want early shows, and then no one shows up for them.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think there's a – someone was saying while we were talking about it, you know, if you're going to do it, you have to commit to it and stick with it. But I don't know if the clubs can really afford to make a 6-month investment in no one coming out until it sticks. That's a hard thing when they know. And a lot of those clubs are especially the Empty Glass, is, you know – patronized a lot by the service industry, who aren't getting off until midnight.
That's true.
A lot of the crowd you get on the weeknights and even the weekends at the Empty Glass is just service industry folk. So if people came out and patronized the Empty Glass to come see shows more often, the crowd would dictate when the shows are. Where right now, the crowd is dictating when the shows are.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of an odd conundrum to be in, but if that's when they want me to play, that's when I'll play. But, you know, I think West Virginia's got a really good music scene. We've got a lot of great artists. We have a few bands that draw. And a lot of times those bands are, especially in West Virginia, more of the like kind of good time dancing, you know, like excitable bands.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, you've got your red, like Tyler Childers. I guess he's a West Virginia artist. I always never know.
We adopted him.
I was going to say, I like everybody's adopted him. But he's one of those guys that is just so compelling that even solo, like people just flock to his shows, you know. But outside of that, like, you've got the bands that draw, but it's always kind of the, you know, the same ones. And even them, it's tough. But, you know, I've tried to go out to shows a lot more than I used to. I used to be like, well, I play so much. I'm trying to, like, get out and support anybody and everybody I can. And if I think if everybody did that, we'd have a better music scene.
Yeah. Beyond like a potential venue change, what's something that you hope for the West Virginia music scene moving forward? Maybe to help your career or just the general state?
You know, I was talking to someone several months ago about how much the West Virginia music scene was doing so well. And they said, of course it is. Anytime there's a depression in an area economically, the arts flourish. And I was like, oh yeah, it's kind of a good point. And our economy's kind of... Well, I mean, it's not a surprise or a shock that we've always kind of been way down on that. So we don't really feel the effects of the recession so much because we're kind of just already there. So the arts is kind of where we flourish. And I think that everybody's really proud of that. But I don't think you've got your Charlestonites and your Huntingtonites that definitely go out and go to shows and they do whatever. But with a state with only 1 million-plus people in it, we need more of the general population involved. So... I don't know if, you know, I think Live on the Levee is a good example. that's a good way to get the general public that wouldn't typically go out to see shows, that wouldn't typically go out and see the art that's going on, that wouldn't typically do that, to be involved in it. A festival, you know, is another one. You know, I think those are ways that we're getting the general public of West Virginia, people like my mom and your friends that just have kids and don't go out to shows, they don't go out and check out this, that are like, man, I'm really proud of the people doing it, to get them involved in it. And I think, you know, you get a place like Cincinnati or Columbus, you only need a small section of that. You know, we almost need all of us to kind of band together for that. So I think that's, I think maybe that's where we need to get with it, is like everybody. And Dusty Hurley, who's the president of the Putnam County Convention and Visitors Bureau, has been really going out of her way to highlight Putnam County artists, restaurants, musicians, just all of it. And so she did 30 days Putnam Tastes and Talents back in March, and it was like she highlighted a restaurant and an artist of some sort each night for like the entire month. And so I did some work for him at one point, and she found out I was a musician, found out my music, and so we developed this relationship. So she's always been really cool about pushing me. Anyway, she had us booked at Mountain Pie down in Hurricane the day after I got back from tour. So I'd been gone for a month, and I got back, and I got to do a full band show that night. And people had called like 3 days before to try to reserve a table. The place was packed. It was standing room only. They're not supposed to have standing room because it's a restaurant.
Yeah.
But it was like tons of people came out to see me that never, because we were playing from 6 to 8 or 6:30 to 8:30 or something really early. They could bring their kids because it's a restaurant. They could have a drink. They could watch a show. And so it went over really, really well. All over Taze Valley. All the bands did really well with that. So then she called me and said, well, the Putnam Farmers Market is wanting to book some music on the third Saturday of every month, you know, or whatever. And I was like, sure, put me down for a couple dates beginning in the summer. And so I did that. And, you know, you really don't draw a crowd to a farmers market, but it was really cool. They set me up a tent, and I went and bought some honey and some local produce, and then set it out and played some music, sitting in the grass. And I had a few fans that came and, like, set up chairs in the tent with me and listened. But people that would never heard me otherwise were there. And yeah. I think that people like that, like Dusty, she's going out of her way to try to showcase what's going on in our area. And I think that's what we need more of, that whole community collaboration.
What's a poor boy to do? Sit around and pick the blues. What's a poor boy to do? Sit around and play the blues. No chicken in my pot. Barely soles now on my shoes.
What's been your proud achievement or accomplishment as a musician thus far? Besides being able to pay off your loans on your house.
Yeah.
Which is great. That's an accomplishment.
Yeah, that was nice. I guess when I'd been out of the music scene so long, when I came back, nobody knew me or remembered me, and there were so many new people, they didn't know who I was. And so I wrote that blues album, $2 Suit, and got my band together in April. We played our first show in May of 2016. And we actually released the album in September, and I said, hey, I found a blues competition in Huntington that Chris Sutton runs. Chris Sutton didn't even know I played music. That's how long I'd been out of it. So I called him. He's like, I didn't even know you played music. I was like, yeah, I just been out for a while. And I was like, when's your house competition? Said at the end of the month. So we went down there, and everybody was like, well, who are these people? Because everybody kind of seemed to know all the people. And they came from Cincinnati, and there was some from Virginia, and there was some from Lewisburg, but nobody knew who we were. And we took first place in the thing. And so the judges, some of them were from the Marietta Blues and Jazz Society. Like, well, who are these people? And they were like, we really don't know. So I got to represent West Virginia at the 2017 International Blues Showcase, and we got to go down there and stay a week in Memphis. And so I got to take the whole band, and so we all got to go. And so for these guys who've been playing blues like their whole lives and bands, this was like, you know, I mean, this was like the coolest thing. We got to go play the hard rock, and we got to be there with people from all over the world and network and hang out. And so to come in and not be known, you always feel like, people get the feeling, I think, at times that music is cliquish, and there is some cliques to it. People have the bars have the bands they like, and people have the bands they promote and whatever. So to come as a complete unknown and be actually judged, which no one really likes. No one wants to be judged on the music, but you join a competition, that's what you're doing. And to take it and be an unknown and then go down there was pretty cool. I got, like, teared up. The way they announced it, I thought they'd already announced the winner. I was like, well, you know, I mean, what do we think we're going to do? And then I guess I missed it. And then they announced, and I kind of stood there like dumbfounded, and they gave me the plaque or whatever. I just about lost it. Like, I just won a Grammy or something. But that was really cool. And so, you know, I think that was, for me, like a big highlight because all of us got to be involved. So that was really nice.
If for someone who hasn't heard your music before and they pick up a copy of Oklahoma Blues, how would you describe the record to them?
I always call it a collection of like short stories set to like some sort of Midwestern common man kind of theme, you know, like it's definitely Americana and country with a lot of blues influence and Delta blues influence to it. I was trying to think whenever I picked artists that I thought it sounded like when I was going through like the CD Baby thing, I was like, but Springsteen always comes to mind. Springsteen's Ghost of Tom Joad album and Nebraska solo records were two of my favorite records in the world. And I like how there's this simple element of common people and how they live their lives on the stripes they go through. And Tom Waits touched on that a lot too. So the original name of the album was going to be Whiskey Laden Tales, that this kind of strife and, you know, short stories about kind of the underbelly of, you know, like the American dream, you know. So, but I would say it's like a, you know, Americana, country roots blues kind of record or something. Like I want to throw, because there's some blues in there and you know, it's really hard to describe. It's a really good record. it's your mom's favorite record. And you're going to want to pick up a couple copies.
Tony Hara and the Putnam Prohibition's latest release is Oklahoma Blues. You can find it wherever good music is sold and streamed. 30 Days of West Virginia Music is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting and A Change of Tune. This episode was written, edited, and produced by me, Joni Deutsch. Our associate producer is Nathan Thomas. Our digital promotions come from Josh Saul. Our theme was composed by Matt Jackford and performed by Montana Skies and John Query. You can hear more West Virginia music on A Change of Tune, airing Saturday nights at 10 on West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Follow us on social media. We're at A Change of Tune. And for more West Virginia music chats, make sure to go to wvpublic.org/wvmusic and subscribe to our podcast feed. I'm Joni Deutsch. Thanks for listening.